This is Catherine Hastings, and you're listening to Word Temple on KRCB 91.1 FM. I'm going to begin tonight's program with a tribute to the late poet Lenore Kandel. I'll be reading an obituary written by Julian Guthrie and published in the San Francisco Chronicle, an essay on poetry that Kandel wrote, and then a number of her poems from her book Word Alchemy. Lenore Kandel, 1960s counterculture figure, author of banned poetry. Lenore Kandel hung out with beat poets and was immortalized by Jack Kerouac, wrote a book of love poetry banned as obscene and seized by police, and believed in communal living, anarchic street theater, belly dancing, and all things beautiful. Ms. Kandel, a lyric poet and one of the shining lights of San Francisco's famous counterculture of the 60s, died on October 18th in San Francisco. She was 77 and had been diagnosed with lung cancer 2 weeks earlier. I met Lenore in 1965 at a citywide meeting of artists opposed to the war in Vietnam, said actor Peter Coyote. Lenore was physically beautiful and physically commanding. She had this voluptuous plumpness about her and an absolute serenity. Coyote, Ms. Kandel, and her then-boyfriend Bill Fritch, a poet and Hell's Angel, became fast friends. She was working as a belly dancer and would sew these beaded curtains to make money on the side, said Coyote, a founder of the Diggers, an anarchistic group supplying free food, housing, and medical aid to the needy in San Francisco. We would sit around and smoke dope and talk about philosophy and art. She was an enlightened person, a great being. Born in New York City on January 14, 1932, to Russian and Mongol parents, Ms. Kandel was educated in a one-room schoolhouse in Bucks County, Pennsylvania, where she lived with her grandmother. She began writing poetry as a child, attended college in New York, and moved to San Francisco around 1960, toward the end of the Beat era. Once here, she became the girlfriend of poet Lou Welch and friends with the movement's seminal figures, including Gary Snyder, Neil Cassidy, and Allen Ginsberg. In Big Sur, Kerouac's 1962 novel, Ms. Kandel is portrayed as Romana Swartz, a big Romanian monster beauty, and Welch as Dave Wayne. By the mid-60s, Ms. Kandel was a key figure in the burgeoning hippie scene in the Haight-Ashbury. Her book of poetry, The Love Book, published in 1966, was deemed pornographic, and the famed psychedelic shop on Haight Street, where it was sold, was raided by the police. Copies were confiscated on the grounds that their display and sale excited lewd thoughts, and the store's owners were arrested. The Love Book was extremely graphic sexually, said Gerald Nicosia, a Kerouac biographer and Beat Generation chronicler. She showed this openness to sexuality, this freedom of lifestyle. With The Love Book, she became a cause célèbre. But Lenore was a true lyric poet. Her language was as beautiful as anything being written. Ms. Kandel wrote another book of poetry, Word Alchemy, published in 1967. The same year, she was the only woman to speak on stage at the Human Being in Golden Gate Park. She went from the beat community to the Diggers to being a major player at the Human Being, said the poet and beat documentarian who goes by the name of Kush. She was a very deep poet, and she was committed to radical values and transforming culture. Longtime friend Vicky Pollock, also a member of the Diggers, met Kandel in 1968. I saw her read from Word Alchemy, which is her most beautiful work, Pollock said. It changed the way I saw poetry. She became, for me, a rock star. In recent years, Ms. Kandel, who had suffered grievous spinal injuries and a motorcycle crash aboard Fritch's Harley, was confined to her small apartment on Folsom Street. She continued to write, her friends say, and to find joy in everyday encounters. She was in a lot of pain because of her back, said Pollock, but she got enjoyment out of everything and anything. Lenore had what I call the gift of happiness. That was an obituary written by Julian Guthrie in the San Francisco Chronicle, and I thank Mr. Guthrie for giving me permission to read this obituary. Next, I'm going to read an essay that Lenore Kandel wrote. It appears in the beginning of her book, Word Alchemy. It's on poetry, and I think it's important enough to read. Poetry is never compromise. It is the manifestation, translation of a vision, an illumination, an experience. If you compromise your vision, you become a blind prophet. There is no point today in that poetry which exists mainly as an exercise in dexterity. Craft is valuable insofar as it serves as a brilliant midwife for clarity, beauty, vision. When it becomes enamored of itself, it produces word masturbation. The poems I write are concerned with all aspects of the creature and of that total universe through which he moves. The aim is toward the increase of awareness. It may be awareness of the way a bird shatters the sky with his flight, or awareness of the difficulty and necessity of trust, or awareness of the desire for awareness, and also the fear of awareness. This may work through beauty or shock or laughter, but the direction is always toward clear sight, both interior and exterior. This demands honesty within the poet and the poem, an honesty sometimes joyful and sometimes painful, whether to the poet or to the reader or both. Two poems of mine, published as a small book, deal with physical love and the invocation, recognition, and acceptance of the divinity in man through the medium of physical love. In other words, it feels good. It feels so good that you can step outside your private ego and share the grace of the universe. This simple and rather self-evident statement, enlarged and exampled poetically, raised a furor difficult to believe. A large part of the furor was caused by the poetic usage of certain four-letter words of Anglo-Saxon origin instead of the substitution of gentle euphemisms. This brings up the question of poetic language. Whatever is language is poetic language, and if the word required by the poet does not exist in his known language, then it is up to him to discover it. The only proviso can be that the word be the correct word as demanded by the poem, and only the poet can be the ultimate judge of that. Euphemisms chosen by fear are a covenant with hypocrisy and will immediately destroy the poem and eventually destroy the poet. Any form of censorship, whether mental, moral, emotional, or physical, whether from the inside out or the outside in, is a barrier against self-awareness. Poetry is alive because it is a medium of vision and experience. It is not necessarily comfortable. It is not necessarily safe. Poetry has moved out of the classroom and into the street and thus brought about a flow of cross-pollination, many of the fruits of which are viable in both mediums. Academia tended to breed the fear of offense, i.e. that which might offend someone. Visions and language both were often dwarfed and muted, the poem too often becoming a vehicle for literary gymnastics. Street poetry avoids the fear trap, but too often loses its visions through a lack of clarity, through sloppiness, through a lack of the art of craft. Poetry as poetry has no need to be classified in either of the above pigeonholes, nor in any other. It exists. It cannot exist in the company of censorship. When a poet censors his vision, he no longer tells the truth as he sees it. When he censors the language of the poem, he does not use those words which to him are the most perfect words to be used. This self-stunting results in an artificial limitation imposed on an art whose direction is beyond the limits of the conceivable. There are no barriers to poetry or prophecy. By their nature, they are barrier breakers, bursts of perception, lines into infinity. If a poet lies about his vision, he lies about himself and in himself. This produces a true barrier. When a poet, through fearful expediency, uses language other than that which is perfect to the poem, he becomes a person of fearful expediency. When an outside agency takes it upon itself to attempt the censorship of poetry, it is censoring the acceptance of truth and the leap toward revelation. When a society becomes afraid of its poets, it is afraid of itself. A society afraid of itself stands as another definition of hell. A poem that is written and published becomes available to those who choose to read it. This seems to me to imply one primary responsibility on the part of the poet, that he tell the truth as he sees it, that he tell it as beautifully, as amazingly as he can, that he ignite his own sense of wonder, that he work alchemy within the language. These are the form and existence of poetry itself. A good part of the audience for modern poetry is young. We move in a world where the polarities and possibilities of life and death exist as a constant consciousness. Once the concept and availability of overkill was made public knowledge, the aura of the possibility of cosmic death became visible. There have been eras when the young could slip softly into their elders' lives, when if they wanted to ignore the deeper issues of humanity, of man's relationship to man, it was made easy for them. This is not such a time, and the choices of the young are deep and hard. At 18, the young men must decide whether they will enter into the national pastime of death. A great many of the young are choosing to manifest a different way of life, one motivated toward pleasure, toward enlightenment, and toward mutual concern, instead of accepting the world of war and personal despair which has been offered them by the majority of their elders. There are heavy choices to make, and there is no avoidance possible. Those who read modern poetry do so for pleasure, for insight, sometimes for counsel. The least they can expect is that the poet who shares his visions and experiences with them do so with no hypocrisy. To compromise poetry through fear is to atrophy the psyche. To compromise poetry through expediency is the soft, small murder of the soul. That was Lenore Kandel. Here's something that Lenore Kandel wrote about herself. I was born under the sign of Capricorn, originally in New York City and later in Pennsylvania, Los Angeles, San Francisco, and other occasions. I am no longer a professional belly dancer, school bus driver, or choir singer. I stand witness for the divine animal and the possibility of the ecstatic access of enlightenment. My favorite word is yes. Next, I'm going to read a number of Kandel's poems from her book, Word Alchemy. Enlightenment Poem. We have all been brothers, hermaphroditic as oysters, bestowing our pearls carelessly. No one yet had invented ownership, nor guilt, nor time. We watched the seasons pass. We were as crystalline as snow, and melted gently into newer forms as stars spun around our heads. We had not learned betrayal. Ourselves were pearls, irritants transmuted into luster and offered carelessly. Our pearls became more precious and our sexes static. Mutability grew a shell. We devised different languages, new words for new concepts. We invented alarm clocks, fences, loyalty. Still, even now, making a feint at communion, infinite perceptions. I remember we have all been brothers, and offer carelessly. Now vision. We all lived all together in one, how sleeping in our various and separate rooms, and I woke where I slept, in the arms of one who loved me, leaving four-letter words undefined. Oh, yes, I loved port wine warming my belly, sweetening my mouth, turning on my spirits even more. I loved my pot curling incense up my head, sliding ashes of laughter out my teeth, attar of roses, riding the vision night. I loved the sun sucking in through my skin like a miser opening my mouth and my legs for the pretty sunshine, loved the cold old fog, loved the long wet rain yet. My best and oldest friend in turning on the world forgot my name and left me hanging paranoid for 27 minutes on an ill-used street with rescue and unasked stranger leading me beyond destruction, cities below the earth, embracing me, and we made love with each other, sinking inexorably below the ground and waking as a bird, all hollow-boned, living together as we did. The house began to change itself. The day we gave up time, my room turned golden. Once we sat to dinner along the brown and broken table with 12 faces, 24 hands, 48 articulated limbs and knives and forks, all making motions in the ritual air, the masticating teeth, saliva, slippage down the long canal, and peristalsis, little nodule muscles, pushing in all of the busy bellies. I looked around my eyes at fork level and saw 11 sets of hands and one of golden paws taloned, feral clawed, blood-stained, I was afraid to look up and view what face or lack of one slipped down under the table and through the legs, not looking backward, and through the curtained doorway out, along the endless dusty hallway. I dreamt my door opened into limbo. I hung suspended there in nowhere, while vampire bats twittered all the empty bed night, with the moon burning my window and the wind at my door. I could hear the earth turn and the stones crying in the fields, and the ice crystals forming and shattering in my body veins. My head was an unswept attic, a Ferris wheel of dust swinging through deserted fairgrounds on a rainy night. My eyes leaked cobwebs. Tomorrow I left my room singing Chinese love songs out of the stretch of night. Oh, yes, there were days and hours, and I have walked this town until I have circled the universe, walking these streets back and forth and hiding in the bird sanctuary house we lived in. And I walked down the hall and opened my door into Turkish jazz and blew incense over the ceiling and lay down and wept for all the beautiful people. Now we all lived in this house, and there was Maru with her beautiful Mississippi bones and her dead baby staring thinly out the window and waiting to jump while her loving lover loved love somehow else and in another land. And there were more passed out on the kitchen floor drunk again. There were bearded angels hugging scimitars. There were unknown soldiers and glory diggers. There were Zen monks and lovely ladies. There were sunflowers in the morning, and passing the evening hours, I drank blue vervain tea, which tasted like bitter flowers, like apricot kernels, like witch fingers in this house, sheltering many passers-by, for this world is a bridge, they say, and it is a long time in crossing, and we here ran a tea-house with many exits. Oh, the night hours, the light hours, the bright hours, all the hours bundled up into each other made such a small package, and all we really had. Oh, yes, we are someone else now, painting our eyes with the seasons. I am a big angel bird squatting in a dark room, watching my feathers grow. They burst my skin infinitely. A blind seraph performing the Indian rope trick on a subway train. The season has changed. The rain has washed away the earth, and the flesh and the bones are whispering white secrets. This is the bridge. This is the bridge, and there is no way back. Rose Vision. Permit me the concept of the rose, the perfumed labyrinth that leads one petal at a time into oblivion's heart. There are visions within the silence of the rose. Here in these velvet rooms, accessible to dream, I open my eyes into darkness until my vision of itself ignites the air. And I not only see, but am all possibilities of time and space and change, from which there is no place to hide, no season of serenity, no solid ground. And Mother Chaos grips my trembling hand, and with my fingers tears the veil from her head, and shows me my own pale face against the sparkling void, and I am bereft of explanations. I am at the turning of the labyrinth, and there is only one direction, and it surrounds me. And I am at the turning of the labyrinth, and there is only one way to go. The rose contains infinity. I hold the rose and walk within the velvet tunnels of its dream. There is no way to stop or stand, and there is only one way to go. Anatomy note. The hand is a flower. Space moves the hand through areas of time. The gesture blooms and dies. Small prayer for falling angels. Too many of my friends are junkies. Too many of my psychic kin tattoo invisible revelations on themselves, signing their manifestos to etheric consciousness with little hoofprint scars reaching from fingertip to fingertip, a gory religiosity akin to Kali's sacred necklace of 50 human heads. Kali Ma, Kali Mother, Kali Ma, Kali Mother, too many of my friends are running out of blood, their veins are collapsing, it takes them half an hour to get a hit, their blood whispers through their bodies, singing its own death chant, in a voice of fire, in a voice of glaciers, in a voice of sand that blows forever over emptiness. Kali Ma, remember the giving of life as well as the giving of death. Kali Ma, remember the desire is for enlightenment and not oblivion. Kali Ma, their bones are growing light, help them to fly. Kali Ma, their eyes burn with the pain of fire, help them that they see with clear sight. Kali Ma, their blood sings death to them, remind them of life, that they be born once more, that they slide bloody through the gates of yes, that they relax their hands, nor try to stop the movement of the flowing now. Too many of my friends have fallen into the white heat of the only flame. May they fly higher, may there be no end to flight. Junk Angel. I have seen the junky angel winging his devious path over cities, his green-black pinions parting the air with the sound of fog. I have seen him plummet to earth, folding his feathered bat wings against his narrow flesh, pausing to share the horizons of some ecstatic acolyte. The bone shines through his face, and he exudes the rainbow odor of corruption. His eyes are spirals of green radioactive mist, luminous even in sunlight, even at noon. His footstep is precise, his glance is tender. He has no mouth nor any other feature, but whirling eyes above the glaring faceless face. He never speaks and always understands, he answers no one. Radiant with a black-green radiance, he extends his hollow-fingered hands, blessing, 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 his Icarus hollow fingers caressing the shadow of the man with love and avarice, and then unfurls his wings and rides the sky like an enormous Christian bat, and voiceless flies behind the sun. Naked I have known you. Naked I have known you. I have watched your face open in the wet heat of love, your mouth of words become hunger, and your tongue a delicate animal. I have known you. I have known you, the skeleton exquisite walking the bright red flesh, cocooned in vegetable fiber and plastic and the skins of dead animals, moving with careful articulation through forest of concrete, eye-holes anxious at jungle intersections, the blare of sound, an imprecation at finger-edge. The only way to walk is one foot in front of the other. Fly then, God damn you! Which animal, scurrying to covens underground, rat brother, altar of subway trains, carrier of death capsule immaculate, V.D., is watching you? Oh, junky doorway, God love, the tremor of affliction beating your hand against your other face. I have known you. Wide eagle of high land, I have seen your fingers elongate and burn. I have watched your groin flower. I have known you. Naked, I have known you. I have devoured your head smashed through. Mirror glass into dimensions uncontrollable, I have found you. Crystalline guts draped over across my tongue and eyeballs, and your left hand in my stomach, and I am digesting it. The most noticeable thing when falling into the sun is the exquisite sensation of warmth. Sunflower, sunflower dance floor, sunflower radio station, sunflower time bomb, sunflower dog kennel, sunflower Christmas tree, sunflower no trespassing, sunflower white only, sunflower exit. Naked, I have known you hiding behind movie sets, turning yourself into Holocaust. Altar of wind wheels, lobotomy dancer, I have seen your eyelids nictate lace curtains. I have seen you 8 feet high and skinny parading the city, dumps, hand-weaving witch signs and screaming. Naked I have sunflower you, and the traffic backed up for miles. I have watched your face sunflower the keyhole beds of hothouse dirt, and rare plants patterning your cheekbones, mouth of sea anemone, and I have kissed it. Red animal, I have green plant you, altar of hawk shops, and I have seen your face. Blues for Sister Sally. Moon-faced baby with cocaine arms, 19 summers, 19 lovers. Novice of the junkie angel, lay sister of mankind penitent, sister in marijuana, sister in hashish, sister in morphine, against the bathroom grimy sink, pumping your arms full of life, holy, holy, she bears the stigma, holy, holy, of the raving Christ, holy, holy, holy needle, holy powder, holy vein. Dear Miss Lovelorn, my sister makes it with a hunk of glass. Do you think this is normal, Miss Lovelorn? I demand an answer. Weep. For my sister, she walks with open veins, leaving her blood in the sewers of your cities, from East Coast to West Coast to nowhere. How shall we canonize our sister who is not quite dead, who fornicates with strangers, who masturbates with needles, who is afraid of the dark and wears her long hair soft and black against her bloodless face? Midnight, in the room dream green and hazy, we are all part of the collage. Brother and sister, she leans against the wall, and he, slipping the needle in her painless arm, pale fingers, with love, against the pale arm. Children, our afternoon is soft, we lean against each other, our stash is in our elbows, our fix is in our heads. God is a junkie, and he has sold salvation for a week's supply. Those are just some of the poems that appear in Word Alchemy, poems by Lenore Kandel. Lenore Kandel died in San Francisco in October of this year.
Chasing rabbits, and you know you're going to fall. Tell 'em a hookah, smoking caterpillar, has given you the call. Call Alice when she was just small.
That was, of course, the Jefferson Airplane performing White Rabbit. It's time to change the mood here a bit. Up next, James Taylor sings Winter Wonderland, and immediately following that standard, I'll play a recording of Dylan Thomas reading A Child's Christmas in Wales, his recollection of the sounds and smells of Christmas in the Welsh seaside town of his youth. This is Catherine Hastings, and you're listening to Word Temple on KRCB 91.1 FM.
Sleigh bells ring, are you listening? In the lane, snow is glistening. Beautiful sight, we're happy tonight, walking in a winter wonderland. Gone away is the bluebird, here to stay is the new bird. Sing a love song as we roll along, walking in a winter wonderland. snowman and pretend that he is Parson Brown. He'll say, God, you're merry. We'll say, no, man, no. But you can do the job if you're in town. Later on, we'll conspire as we dream by fire to face unafraid plans that we made, walking in a winter wonderland.
One Christmas was so much like the other in those years around the Seatown corner now, out of all sound except the distant speaking of the voices I sometimes hear a moment before sleep, that I can never remember whether it snowed for 6 days and 6 nights when I was 12, or whether it snowed for 12 days and 12 nights when I was 6. All the Christmases rolled down towards the two-tongued sea like a cold and headlong moon bundling down the sky that was our street. And they stop at the rim of the ice-edged, fish-freezing waves, and I plunge my hands in the snow and bring out whatever I can find. In goes my hand into that wool-white, bell-tongued ball of holidays resting at the rim of the carol-singing sea, and out come Mrs. Prothero and the firemen. It was on the afternoon of the day of Christmas Eve, and I was in Mrs. Prothero's garden, waiting for cats with her son, Jim. It was snowing. It was always snowing at Christmas. December, in my memory, is white as Lapland, although there were no reindeers. But there were cats. Patient, cold, and callous, our hands wrapped in socks, we waited to snowball the cats. Sleek and long as jaguars and horrible whiskered, spitting and snarling, they would slide and sidle over the white back garden walls, and the lynx-eyed hunters, Jim and I, fur-capped and moccasined trappers from Hudson Bay off Mumbles Road, would hurl our deadly snowballs at the green of their eyes. The wise cats never appeared. We were so still, Eskimo-footed Arctic marksmen in the muffling silence of the eternal snows, eternal ever since Wednesday, that we never heard Mrs. Prothero's first cry from her igloo at the bottom of the garden. Or if we heard it at all, it was to us like the far-off challenge of our enemy and prey, the neighbor's polar cat. But soon the voice grew louder. "Fire!" cried Mrs. Prothero, and she beat the dinner gong. And we ran down the garden with the snowballs in our arms towards the house. And smoke, indeed, was pouring out of the dining room. And the gong was bombolating. And Mrs. Protheroe was announcing ruin like a town crier in Pompeii. This was better than all the cats in Wales standing on the wall in a row. We bounded into the house laden with snowballs and stopped at the open door of the smoke-filled room. Something was burning, all right. Perhaps it was Mr. Protheroe, who always slept there after midday dinner with a newspaper over his face. But he was standing in the middle of the room saying, "A fine Christmas," and smacking at the smoke with a slipper. "Call the fire brigade," cried Mrs. Protheroe as she beat the gong. "They won't be here," said Mr. Protheroe. "It's Christmas." There was no fire to be seen, only clouds of smoke, and Mr. Protheroe standing in the middle of them, waving his slipper as though he were conducting. "Do something," he said. And we threw all our snowballs into the smoke. I think we missed Mr. Protheroe, and ran out of the house to the telephone box. "Let's call the police as well," Jim said, "and the ambulance. And Ernie Jenkins, he likes fires." But we only called the fire brigade. And soon the fire engine came, and three tall men in helmets brought a hose into the house, and Mr. Protheroe got out just in time before they turned it on. Nobody could have had a noisier Christmas Eve. And when the firemen turned off the hose and were standing in the wet, smoky room, Jim's aunt, Miss Protheroe, came downstairs and peered in at them. Jim and I waited very quietly to hear what she would say to them. She said the right thing, always. She looked at the three tall firemen in their shining helmets, standing among the smoke and cinders and dissolving snowballs, and she said, "Would you like anything to read?" Years and years ago, when I was a boy, when there were wolves in Wales, and birds the color of red flannel petticoats whisked past the harp-shaped hills, when we sang and wallowed all night and day in caves that smelt like Sunday afternoons in damp front farmhouse parlors, and we chased with the jawbones of deacons the English and the bears. Before the motor car, before the wheel, before the Duchess-faced horse, when we rode the daft and happy hills bareback, it snowed and it snowed. But here a small boy says, "It snowed last year, too. I made a snowman, and my brother knocked it down, and I knocked my brother down, and then we had tea." But that was not the same snow, I say. Our snow was not only shaken from whitewashed buckets down the sky. It came shawling out of the ground and swam and drifted out of the arms and hands and bodies of the trees. Snow grew overnight on the roofs of the houses like a pure and grandfather moss. Minutely ivied the walls and settled on the postman opening the gate like a dumb, numb thunderstorm of white, torn Christmas cards. Were there postmen then, too? With sprinkling eyes and wind-cherried noses on spread, frozen feet, they crunched up to the doors and mittened on them manfully. But all that the children could hear was a ringing of bells. You mean that the postman went rat-a-tat-tat and the doors rang? I mean that the bells that the children could hear were inside them. I only hear thunder sometimes, never bells. There were church bells, too. Inside them? No, 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 in the bat-black, snow-white belfries tugged by bishops and storks. And they rang their tidings over the bandaged town, over the frozen foam of the powder and ice cream hills, over the crackling sea. It seemed that all the churches boomed for joy under my window, and the weathercocks crew for Christmas on our fence. Get back to the postman. They were just ordinary postmen, fond of walking and dogs and Christmas and the snow. They knocked on the doors with blue knuckles. Ours has got a black knocker. And then they stood on the white welcome mat in the little drifted porches and huffed and puffed, making ghosts with their breath, and jogged from foot to foot like small boys wanting to go out. And then the presents, after the Christmas box. and the cold postman with a rose on his button nose tingled down the tea-tray slithered run of the chilly, glinting hill. He went in his ice-boned boots like a man on fishmonger's slabs. He wagged his bag like a frozen camel's hump, dizzily turned the corner on one foot, and by God, he was gone. Get back to the presents. There were the useful presents, engulfing mufflers of the old coach days and mittens made for giant sloths, zebra scarves of a substance like silky gum that could be tug-of-war down to the galoshes, blinding tam-o-shanters like patchwork tea cozies and bunny-suited busbies and balaclavas for victims of head-shrinking tripes. From aunts who always wore wool next to the skin, there were moustached and rasping vests that made you wonder why the aunts had any skin left at all. And once I had a little crocheted nosebag from an aunt now, alas, no longer whinnying with us. And pictureless books in which small boys, though warned with quotations not to, would skate on Farmer Giles's pond and did and drowned. And books that told me everything about the wasp, except why. Go on to the useless presents. Bags of moist and many-colored jelly babies, and a folded flag and a false nose and a tram conductor's cap and a machine that punched tickets and rang a bell. Never a catapult. Once, by a mistake that no one could explain, a little hatchet. And a celluloid duck that made, when you pressed it, a most unduck-like sound. A mewing moo that an ambitious cat might make who wished to be a cow. And a painting book in which I could make the grass, the trees, the sea, and the animals any color I please. And still the dazzling sky-blue sheep are grazing in the red field under the rainbow billed and pea-green birds. Hard-boiled toffee, fudge and all sorts, crunches, cracknel, humbugs, glaciers, marzipan, and butter Welsh for the Welsh. And troops of bright tin soldiers who, if they could not fight, could always run. And snakes and families and happy ladders and easy hobby games for little engineers, complete with instructions. Oh, easy for Leonardo. And a whistle to make the dogs bark, to wake up the old man next door, to make him beat on the wall with his stick, to shake our picture off the wall. And a packet of cigarettes. You put one in your mouth and you stood at the corner of the street and you waited for hours in vain for an old lady to scold you for smoking a cigarette, and then with a smirk you ate it. And then it was breakfast under the balloons. Were there uncles like in our house? There are always uncles at Christmas, the same uncles. And on Christmas mornings with dog-disturbing whistle and sugar fags, I would scour the swathed town for the news of the little world and find always a dead bird by the post office or the white deserted swings. Perhaps a robin, all but one of his fires out. Men and women wading, scooping back from chapel with taproom noses and wind-busked cheeks, all albinos, huddled their stiff black jarring feathers against the irreligious snow. Mistletoe hung from the gas brackets in all the front parlors. There was sherry and walnuts and bottled beer and crackers by the dessert spoons. And cats in their furabouts watched the fires. And the high-heaped fires spat, all ready for the chestnuts and the mulling pokers. Some few large men sat in the front parlors without their collars, uncles almost certainly, trying their new cigars, holding them out judiciously at arm's length, returning them to their mouths, coughing, then holding them out again as though waiting for the explosion. And some few small aunts, not wanted in the kitchen, nor anywhere else for that matter, sat on the very edges of their chairs, poised and brittle, afraid to break like faded cups and saucers. Not many those mornings trod the piling streets. An old man, always fawn-bowlered, yellow-gloved, and at this time of year with spats of snow, would take his constitutional to the white bowling green and back as he would take it wet or fire or on Christmas Day or Doomsday. Sometimes two hale young men with big pipes blazing, no overcoats and wind-blown scarves, would trudge unspeaking down to the forlorn sea to work up an appetite to blow away the fumes, who knows, to walk into the waves until nothing of them was left but the two curling smoke clouds of their inextinguishable briars. Then I would be slap-dashing home, the gravy smell of the dinners of others, the bird smell, the brandy, the pudding and mince coiling up to my nostrils, when out of a snow-clogged side lane would come a boy, the spit of myself, with a pink-tipped cigarette and the violet past of a black eye, cocky as a bullfinch, leering all to himself. I hated him on sight and sound, and would be about to put my dog whistle to my lips and blow him off the face of Christmas, when suddenly he, with a violet wink, put his whistle to his lips and blew so stridently, so high, so exquisitely loud, that gobbling faces, their cheek bulged with goose, would press against their tinseled windows the whole length of the white echoing street. For dinner we had turkey and blazing pudding, and after dinner the uncles sat in front of the fire, loosened all buttons, put their large, moist hands over their watch chains, groaned a little, and slept. Mothers, aunts, and sisters scuttled to and fro bearing tureens. Aunt Bessie, who had already been frightened twice by a clockwork mouse, whimpered at the sideboard and had some elderberry wine. The dog was sick. Auntie Dursey had to have 3 aspirins, but Auntie Hannah, who liked port, stood in the middle of the snowbound backyard, singing like a big-bosomed thrush. I would blow up balloons to see how big they would blow up to, and then when they burst, which they all did, the uncles jumped and rumbled. In the rich and heavy afternoon, the uncles breathing like dolphins and the snow descending, I would sit among festoons and Chinese lanterns and nibble dates and try to make a model man-o-war following the instructions for little engineers and produce what might be mistaken for a sea-going tramcar. Or I would go out, my bright new boots squeaking into the white world onto the seaward hill, to call on Jim and Dan and Jack, and to pad through the still streets, leaving huge, deep footprints on the hidden pavements. I bet people will think they've been hippos. What did you do if you saw a hippo coming down our street? I'd go like this, bang! I'd throw him over the railings and roll him down the hill, and then I'd tickle him under the ear and he'd wag his tail. What would you do if you saw 2 hippos? Iron-flanked and bellowing he-hippos clanked and battered through the scudding snow towards us as we passed Mr. Daniel's house. Let's post Mr. Daniel a snowball through his letterbox. Let's write things in the snow. Let's write, Mr. Daniel looks like a spaniel all over his lawn. Or we walked on the white shore. Can the fishes see it snowing? The silent, one-clouded heavens drifted onto the sea. Now we were snow-blind travelers lost on the North Hills, and vast, dew-lapped dogs with flasks round their necks ambled and shambled up to us, baying Excelsior. We returned home through the poor streets, where only a few children fumbled with bare red fingers in the wheel-rutted snow and cat-called after us, their voices fading away as we trudged uphill into the cries of the dock birds and the hooting of ships out in the whirling bay. And then at tea, the recovered uncles would be jolly, and the ice cake loomed in the center of the table like a marble grave. Auntie Hannah laced her tea with rum because it was only once a year. Bring out the tall tales now, that we told by the fire as the gaslight bubbled like a diver. Ghosts wooed like owls in the long nights when I dared not look over my shoulder. Animals lurked in the cubbyhole under the stairs where the gas meter ticked. And I remember that we went singing carols once when there wasn't the shaving of a moon to light the flying streets. At the end of a long road was a drive that led to a large house. And we stumbled up the darkness of the drive that night, each one of us afraid, each one holding a stone in his hand, in case, and all of us too brave to say a word. The wind through the trees made noises as of old and unpleasant and maybe web-footed men wheezing in caves. We reached the black bulk of the house. What shall we give them? Hark the herald? No, Jack said. Good King Wenceslas. I'll count three. One, two, three. And we began to sing, our voices high and seemingly distant in the snow-felted darkness round the house that was occupied by nobody we knew. We stood close together near the dark door. Good King Wenceslas last looked out on the feast of Stephen. And then a small, dry voice, like the voice of someone who has not spoken for a long time, joined our singing. A small, dry eggshell voice from the other side of the door. A small, dry voice through the keyhole. And when we stopped running, we were outside our house. The front room was lovely. Balloons floated under the hot water bottle, gulping gas. Everything was good again and shone over the town. Perhaps it was a ghost, Jim said. Perhaps it was trolls, Dan said, who was always reading. Let's go in and see if there's any jelly left, Jack said. And we did that. Always on Christmas night, there was music. An uncle played the fiddle, a cousin sang Cherry Ripe, and another uncle sang Drake's Drum. It was very warm in the little house. Auntie Hannah, who had got onto the parsnip wine, sang a song about bleeding hearts and death, and then another in which she said her heart was like a bird's nest. And then everybody laughed again, and then I went to bed. Looking through my bedroom window, out into the moonlight and the unending smoke-colored snow, I could see the lights in the windows of all the other houses on our hill, and hear the music rising from them up the long, steadily falling night. I turned the gas down. I got into bed. I said some words to the close and holy darkness, and then I slept.
You just heard Dylan Thomas reading A Child's Christmas in Wales. And finally, up next is Allen Ginsberg reading Come On, Pigs of Western Civilization, Eat More Grease.
Come on, pigs of Western civilization, eat more grease. Eat, eat more marbled sirloin, more pork and gravy. Lard up the dressing. Fry chicken in boiling oil. Carry it dribbling to gray clime, snowed with salt. Little lambs covered with mint, roast in racks, surrounded by roast potatoes wet with butter sauce. Buttered veal medallions in creamy saliva. Buttered beef by glistening mountains of French fries. Stroganoffs and white hot sour cream. Chops soaked in olive oil. Surrounded by olives, salty feta cheese. Followed by Roquefort and Bleu and Stilton, thirsty for wine. Beer, Coca-Cola, Fanta, Champagne, Pepsi, Retsina, Arak, whiskey, vodka. Ah! Watch out, heart attack. Pop some angina pills. Order a plate of bratwurst. Fried Frankfurters, couple billion wimpies, McDonald burgers to the moon and burp. Salt on those fries. Boil onions and breaded mushroom, even zucchini in deep hot Crisco pans. Turkeys die only once. Look nice next to tall white glasses, sugar milk, and ice cream vanilla balls. Strawberry for sweeter color milkshakes with hot dogs. Forget green beans. Every day a few carrots. A mini big spoonful of salty rice will do. Make the plate pretty. Throw in some vinegar pickles, briny sauerkraut. Check your cholesterol. Swallow a pill and order a sugar cream donut. Pack two under your size 44 belt. Pass out in the vomitorium. Come back coughing up strands of sandwich. Still chewing pastrami at Katz's Delicatessen. Back to Central Europe and gobble kielbasa in Wurz. Swallow salami in Munich with beer, liverwurst on pumpernickel in Berlin, greasy cheese on in a three-star hotel near Syntagma on white bread, thick buttered. Set an example for the developing nations. Salt, sugar, animal fat, coffee, tobacco, schnapps. Drop dead faster. Make room for Chinese guest workers with alien soybean curds, green cabbage and rice. Africans, Latins with rice, beans, and calabash can stay thin and crowd in apartments for working-class food freaks. Not like Western cuisine, rich in protein, cancer, heart attack, hypertension, sweat, bloated liver and spleen, megaly, diabetes and stroke, monuments to carnivorous civilizations presently murdering Belfast, Bosnia, Cyprus, Nagorno-Karabakh, Georgia, mailing love letter bombs in Vienna, or setting houses afire in East Germany. Have another coffee. Here's a cigar. And this is a plate of black forest chocolate cake. You deserve it.
He's got rhythm, yeah. When he stomps his feet, he sends me right off to sleep. Check all your razors and your guns. We're gonna be arrested when the wagon comes. Give me a pig foot and a bottle of beer. Send me calls, I don't care. Send me daddy, move right in. I feel just like I want to shout. Give the piano player a drink because he's knocking me out. He's got rhythm. When he stomps his feet, he moves me right off to sleep. Check all your razors and your guns. Do the huckabuck until the rising sun. Give me a pig foot and a bottle of gin. Move me cause I'm in my sin. Give me a pig foot and a bottle of beer. This
is Catherine Hastings, and you're listening to Word Temple on KRCB 91.1 FM. That was, of course, the great Billie Holiday singing Give Me a Pig's Foot and a Bottle of Beer. Before that, Allen Ginsberg read Come On, Western Civilization, Eat More Grease. Tonight's program also featured a tribute to Lenore Kandel, a very important San Francisco poet who died in October 2009, and Dylan Thomas reading A Child's Christmas in Wales. I hope you enjoyed tonight's program. If you did, pop me an email at khastings@wordtemple.com. For a schedule of live, free Word Temple Poetry Series readings coming to Santa Rosa this spring, keep checking in at wordtemple.com. Thanks for listening.